This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
We are living through an age of exponential change. Faster computers, better software, and bigger data means that today's society is defined by constantly accelerating technologies. So in this episode, we're delighted to be joined by Azim Azhar, writer, technologist, and creator of the acclaimed Exponential View newsletter. And he speaks to Roz Irwin about his new book, Exponential, and how from businesses to political institutions, we can adapt to the new powers of technology and ensure human values aren't left behind. It's a really fascinating conversation. And if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for Azim Azhar's new book in the episode description. But now let's go to the episode.
Hello and welcome to this Intelligence Squared podcast with me, Rosamund Irwin, the media and technology correspondent for the Sunday Times. I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, Azim Azhar, creator of Exponential View, Britain's leading platform for an in-depth tech analysis. His weekly newsletter is read by more than 200,000 people from around the world, and his hit podcast has featured guests including Reid Hoffman and Mariana Mazzucato. He's a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Futures Council and a contributor to publications including the Financial Times, Prospect Magazine, and the MIT Technology Review. And he's the author of the new book, Exponential, How Accelerating Technology is Leaving Us Behind and What to Do About It. Welcome today.
Thanks so much, Ross. Really excited to be here.
One of the premises of your book is that we're at this turning point that we haven't seen for nearly 500 years in sort of technological terms. So since the arrival of Gutenberg's printing press. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you, first of all, to categorize what makes us know that we're at a turning point.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it's always a bold claim to make, right, to say that we're at a special moment in history going back 600 years. So I had to think quite hard about before I made that assertion. You know, I think that we all recognize that we live in a world that is infused with much more technology than when we were teenagers and however old you are, really, and that technology is showing up in all sorts of strange places, whether it's supercomputer smartphones that we own, whether it's the way we now have our GP consultations, the idea of having a genome sequence to figure out our propensity for a disease, or electric cars. These things all look like, that they would be science fiction if you'd been a teenager like me in the early to mid 1980s. So that's easy. That's easy to see. But the contention that we're in at a turning point, I think, arises from some simple facts, some things that we could observe happen between about 2011 and 2014. So in 2011, Apple became the biggest company in the world. It replaced ExxonMobil, the oil company. And 2013 became the last time that Exxon actually was ever the biggest company in the world. In 2015, there were about 1.5 billion smartphones sold. In 2006, not a single smartphone had been sold. So that turning point, which happens around 2010 and 2015, is a point where we saw, first of all, the ubiquity of this one of these incredible exponential technologies, computing. It was secondly where this was actually reflected in the structure of our industries, because the world's largest companies in 2008 or 2009 were companies of Henry Ford's era: General Motors, ExxonMobil, the oil companies, AT&T, General Electric, founded by Thomas Edison. And by 2014, 2015, heralded first by Apple, the world's largest companies were all exponential age firms built on these technologies: Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Facebook, Amazon, and these Chinese companies. So that for me marks a really significant phase transition, because it tells us that the technology is ubiquitous and it's now been reflected in the structure of industry and the structure of our economies.
Across history, people have often felt very fearful about change. So people were afraid a bit of lifts, of the telephone, of TV. But today, you know, there are studies that you quote in the book that say people are very nervous that the pace of technological change is happening too fast. What does it do psychologically to people to live through a period where there is so much change so quickly?
Well, we're not made up and constituted to enjoy large amounts of change, especially when it's change that we feel that we can't control. When we feel we're in the driving seat, it's less of an issue. And so you can imagine that there is quite a lot of anxiety that's being expressed at the moment. And I think that anxiety gets expressed in people's attitudes towards technology. Edelman, which is a PR company, runs a global trust barometer. And in the West, certainly, attitudes towards technology and technology companies have really declined significantly since about 2016, 2017. So there is a sense of really, really deep anxiety, and it does get reflected in at least in surveys. But I also think it gets reflected more widely in society, in the notion of the declining sense of trust, the decline in the quality of the civic conversations that we have, because people who are fearful will often and can't control the source of that fear, they don't feel they have agency towards it, will often look for other causes. And so while I'm not saying, and I don't argue in the book, that it's because there are loads of iPhones and they keep doing different things that there was a turn against immigrants or there was a turn towards Donald Trump, I would argue that it contributes to the atmosphere of a sense of lack of control. And there are some really interesting processes which we can look at, and I look at in the book, which show how the development of these technologies has actually contributed to some of the schisms and inequalities that did help to foster some of the political change.
One of the ideas that you explore in the book, and we hear so much from Silicon Valley and you ultimately reject, is that the bosses in Silicon Valley tend to see technology as neutral. And the kind of idea is that how humanity uses the technology is the problem when things go wrong, like what you've just mentioned. Mm. But you really categorically say it from the beginning that it's a fiction that technology is neutral. Why do you think that?
Well, first of all, the reason a boss says a technology is neutral is because it's so easy to do that. That makes your day job really simple. I made it. It's lovely. What you or your neighbour do with it, that's your business. And I can sort of stroll off home and do whatever it is I do. It's a fiction because technologies are artificial constructs that emerge from people or groups of people embedded in society. And so our starting point, the way we look at these problems, the way we choose to look at X data rather than Y data, is really, really determined by our experiences and our priorities. And all of that is part of a social construct. If I'm working for, you know, a company that makes sports cars, I'm much more interested in thinking about the acceleration of the sports car than I am if I'm working for a company that makes little buggies that go around golf courses. And so there is an inherent participation by the individual designer in the design of these products. But the other thing I think that's important is that the products themselves tend to influence us and the things that we therefore care about. And so you can't unpick one from another. Really simple example was when selfies were starting to come out in the start of the 2010s, there was this facial expression, I think, called the duck face, right? Which didn't really exist, right? Yes, you know, the duck face. So then we constructed the duck face, and the technology has started to shape us. So I think that there are two reasons why we need to dispense with this idea of technology being neutral. The first is it gives technology bosses who have a lot of power a pass, and we need to keep power in check. The second is it's just manifestly not correct. Perhaps the second reason is more important than the first.
And you say that the sort of the aim of the book is to look at how to put technology back in the service of society. Mm-hmm. And I want you just in very general terms to say, what has gone wrong? Why is it not currently in the service of society?
Well, I mean, it's a wonderful question. The main reason is that the technologies that we have today are produced by a small number of companies. New companies are arriving all the time. And those companies have a tremendous amount of power, and we don't have ways of necessarily checking that power. And, you know, in the book, I go through a number of different ways in which that manifests itself. One easy example is when we look at how companies operate in an economy. We've always had rules about that. We've had rules about what is good corporate behavior and what's bad corporate behavior. And those rules largely used to keep industrial age companies in check. They didn't get too big, they didn't get too powerful. And then once in a while, the Monopolies and Mergers Commission or the Competition and Markets Authorities would come in and rap someone on the knuckles. In the exponential age, the technologies themselves work differently, and they sort of run around the rules that were developed during the 19th and 20th century. And these companies get bigger and bigger, and they acquire more power, yet they don't appear to be prima facie breaking our old rules. So that's an example where the technologies allow firms to slip outside of society's expectations for what it is to be in service of the greater good.
You introduce this idea of the exponential gap. So as we see technology increase at a pace, at an incredibly rapid pace, but our institutions, from our political norms to sort of the economic side, they simply can't keep up. What effect is that sort of exponential gap having in societal terms?
Well, you know, in societal terms, the primary point is that it doesn't keep power under control, and it doesn't allow us to look after the people who are most impacted by the changes. You know, the purpose of the regulatory institutions of our societies, whether it's habits and norms and customs or tax law or the welfare system or competition law, is essentially to say for a society to be free and to work, we need to keep power in check, and we need to make sure that the worst off are protected in some way, have some mechanism out from their condition. And the exponential gap essentially means that the institutions that we rely on are not keeping pace with the job that they have been asked to do. And that might be something as simple as we've seen being discussed this year about how you tax these exponential age firms. And if you don't tax them, you don't get tax revenue. They get to keep that, and they get more powerful. And the people who benefit from the tax revenue through the provision of social services and welfare services have fewer services to benefit from. And that's a great example of the exponential gap and why it needs to ultimately be closed.
And how do we go about the really big question? How do we go about shrinking this gap?
It is a big question. You know, there are two approaches, because we've got two different things happening. We've got the technologies racing away, and we've got society sort of plodding along like me on a Sunday afternoon. First question, can we do something about the speed with which the technologies develop? And I argue in the book that it's pretty unlikely that we can, because the processes by which these technologies get faster are really baked into a society that is free, that allows free exchange of ideas, that allows people to collaborate. And so when you combine that with humans' natural desire to find shortcuts about anything, you're going to construct this sort of set of accelerating technologies. But what you can do on that top line is you can ask questions about the purpose of those technologies. You can ask questions about the design of the technologies. You can ask questions about who they serve. And I think if you start to do that, you can take the benefit of the acceleration and the faster progress, but have channeled the direction of the technologies in ways that are likely to be somewhat more socially beneficial and slightly less harmful. So that would be the first track, which is let's point this rocket in a slightly more helpful place. And then the second track is what can we do to improve institutional adaptation, right? How can we get, governments and international organizations and schools and families and cities and communities to adapt more appropriately? There's no silver bullet there, but there are some ideas that I think I talk about. You know, I talk about education. I talk about the importance of new styles of safety nets. I also talk about something that I'm very fond of, but many people I think don't like that much, which is the idea of greater subsidiarity towards cities, because cities are where people live and it's where these technologies tend to be developed, and they should have more political and economic control of their environ. That would allow us to have quicker adaptations to these challenges than the pace at which a national government or an international organization moves.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And 1, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
I want to look at one of the particular problems that you address in the book, which is to do with the gig economy, zero hours contracts. So obviously these businesses are becoming bigger and bigger, but labor laws haven't been able to keep up with the new challenges they're presenting. And you say that we're sort of creating a system of increasingly powerful firms and ever more powerless workers. So what do we do to address that fundamental problem? Because I think it's one that society is struggling with and politicians are struggling with profoundly at the moment.
The gig economy is really here to stay. It's too powerful. It's too useful for companies and for enough workers. It's also really, really helpful. It's helpful to be able to have a bit more flexibility, to be able to check in do things. But I think what we got wrong historically with the gig economy, as we see it through the lens of the technology companies, so not so much, you know, 0 hours contracts, which have been going on in the UK for a while, but when things like Uber started to show up in the UK in about 2012, 2011, we were really, really excited. And we sort of suspended our disbelief because we were desperate to look like a technologically advanced country, which looks absurd sort of in hindsight. And so we didn't ask the simple questions around the nature of this work and how we can find ways of getting the best of both worlds. Now, if gig work is going to stay, then what we need to do is we need to ensure that it is fair and it is decent, and there is a fair trade-off between the worker and the gig platform in terms of their rights and all the other things they can do. And right now, it's pretty tough if you're a gig worker in even simple things like you want to get a loan or a mortgage. You won't be treated, your income won't be treated the same way that a salaried worker will be. So your credit score will be worse and you'll pay a higher interest rate and you'll be able to borrow less. So it really hurts. So I think fundamentally we need to identify that there is a new category of labor, that it requires new and additional rights. And those rights might include things like the right to inspect the algorithms and the data that are used to rate workers and hand jobs out to them. The question is, how do you get there? And throughout history, the way that labor has got a better bargain, higher earnings, more rights, has not been through the generosity of the employers. It's been through labor being able to act collectively, workers being able to act collectively and present their case and bargain collectively. Increasingly, the issues are very technical and they're very, very arcane, because it's about, you know, what data are you collecting? What algorithm did you use? Who are you sharing with? Are you blending it with third-party data? I mean, this isn't something that the average person, whoever they are, can deal with. So you need some resource. And so I think workers, especially in the gig economy, need to be able to form some form of collective bargaining entity where they can go in and essentially fight for their rights and figure out what those rights are. Now, I don't think they necessarily look like the rights that workers enjoyed in the 20th century. I mean, they have to be reconceived. But that's the way in which we take that step.
A secondary and slightly related problem is quite how big these companies, some of these companies, these big technology companies have become. The fact that they almost are monopolies and there isn't sufficient competition. And then also the barriers to entry for anyone else wanting to go and do the same thing they're doing. What do we do about that? And are we too late on that score? Because these giant tech companies have got very, very big, and they have been allowed to get very, very big. And it sort of feels quite late to step in and try to do something.
I mean, they're really, really enormous. When I started my newsletter Exponential View in 2015, Apple's value on the stock market had just exceeded $500 billion. And I remember giving speeches and saying to people, hey, you know, Apple's going up and it'll be the first $1 trillion corporation. And the audiences would say, no, that's just crazy. It's nuts. And, you know, as we record today, Apple's market cap is $2.45 trillion. It's nearly five times higher. And it doesn't seem to stop because the forces of gravity that made these companies smaller, which were partially government intervention, but they were largely to do with how the industrial technologies work, no longer hold them back. And these companies have got really good. They've created a new management doctrine that allows them to expand horizontally, that is into other sectors. So Apple makes watches and is getting into healthcare and is getting into cars, but also vertically. So Apple also now makes its own silicon chips and it will offer its own financial services. And they don't seem to have the limits that, you know, traditional management scholars would have argued industry had. And they would have made that argument only 30 years ago. So the question is, how do we tackle this? And I think the approach, again, is slightly multifaceted. Yeah, the first is that where there are infringements of the existing rules, we should now really go after them. And the US has been particularly bad, the FTC, at sort of doing that over the past 10 or 15 years, and they will now be better at doing that. The second is that we need to reframe some of our rules and expectations around what monopoly actually is and what monopoly harms are. And again, I would say the new chair of the FTC, who is this brilliant woman called Lina Khan, has some interesting ideas in that line, along those lines. But the third is just this question of, you know, when you establish yourself as essential to society, even if it's through your own hard labor and your own efforts, you start to develop societal obligations, and we should ask them of you. So now that Google and Microsoft effectively run the digital equivalent of the roads and the water system, for those parts of their business that look like those utilities, we should insist on them behaving the same way that we insist on my local water company, Thames Water, or BT Openreach behaving. Yeah, much higher transparency, much higher disclosure, much lower profit rates, much more higher obligations and clarity of what those obligations are. Now, every one of these big technology companies is quite different. So those interventions, I think the practicality, the detail will vary from one to the other. But there is an idea that I talk about, that these companies are now looking like infrastructure, and where their businesses look like infrastructure, we should treat them as we have treated utilities in the past, with those rules perhaps updated for the 21st century. And then the final idea that I think is really critical for the companies in social media, where there are large networks of us connected, what they have traditionally done, those firms, is they've not allowed us to go from one network to the other. So when you've got a mobile phone and I don't know, you know, you're with the network three, you can call me and I'm on Vodafone. That's fine. One network talks to the other. And if you want to move to Vodafone, you can. A three has to let you do that, and you get to keep your number. And you can call all your friends on three. Now, that doesn't happen between Instagram and TikTok or Facebook and LinkedIn. The social networks maintain this lack of interoperability, and they argue, you know, that it's technically difficult to do. They've started to say it's desirable. I mean, Nick Clegg, who's the head of PR at Facebook, told me a few weeks ago that, oh, well, interoperability is, of course, a desirable thing, but it's technically hard to do. But these companies make hundreds of billions of dollars in profits every year. It's not that hard. So my third prescription is, where there are networks, there needs to be interoperability. And that interoperability would mean that even if I'm not on Facebook, I could still reach my friends on Facebook. And if you're on Facebook and I wasn't, you could still get hold on me. And that would start to weaken some of their inherent network-based power.
You mentioned Nick Clegg there. And one of the things that you identify as a problem in the book is that our politicians, so the ones still in politics, don't tend to have very much understanding of the world of technology. And that there's a sort of culture gap going on between often, you know, arts graduates, often from Oxbridge, and they kind of look down on the technology people, or sort of their technological overlords, really. How can you bring those two worlds together? And so we can have actually have our politicians addressing the problems and understanding, you know, the very basic thing of understanding those problems in the first place.
I'll be optimistic with my response to this. I mean, I think, you know, if you had put bets on, you know, a 70-something year old US president being able to make, say, sensible things towards technology regulation, you might have said, look, it's not really going to happen. But what Joe Biden has demonstrated is his ability to get smart people around him, at least when it comes to monopoly power around Amazon and Apple, you know, perhaps not in other areas right now. So one can be optimistic and say, look, countries can level up. When I look at around, there are a number of places, Estonia, Taiwan, Finland, where there are really smart politicians who understand technology. Within the UK, there are a number of MPs who I really think have started to demonstrate a really deep understanding. I won't, you know, share their names because I'll offend the other 647. And I think the other thing that we're starting to see is more and more people like me who've been in the industry for 25 or 30 years starting to say, look, we want to move into some form of public service in some way where we can bring our expertise along. I think it's not really sufficient, to be honest, because there's only so much that you can do as an advisor. There's only so much the civil service can do. And I've worked with a number of civil servants over the past 2 or 3 years and have been incredibly impressed with their understanding of the dynamics and their open-mindedness. I think the issue is that it's not necessarily even, Roz, individual politicians. I think it's where political rhetoric lies, that people didn't really care about these issues in the UK for the last 4 or 5 years. And I think certainly on the right, and we've got a Conservative government, they haven't really found a way of updating the sort of Thatcherist enterprise cry in a way that they need to. Because, you know, my recommendations for the exponential age are not anti-enterprise. I mean, I'm a startup investor, right, in my day job, and I work with venture capitalists and founders all the time. It's to say that we need enterprise, but there's also certain types of business activities that we absolutely need the state to step in and start to constrain. And I think that sort of Thatcherite protocol needs an update. And that, in a sense, with the Conservative government in power, I think is one of the barriers. It's one of the blockers to getting really, really sensible about these issues.
One of your major themes as well in the book is the impact on globalization of this exponential technologies. And actually, you're arguing that we will become more regionalized and sort of have deglobalization. What would happen in the scenario when things become, you know, producing things through technologies like 3D printing become more localized? And so we have rich companies no longer needing poor companies to the same degree to manufacture their goods. What will happen then?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really complicated and problematic issue, because, you know, what we've already started to see in the last, since I put the book to bed, has been companies who've traditionally manufactured in one place, in like the semiconductor industry, saying we're going to manufacture locally and build factories in Germany, in the UK, in the US, which they hadn't done for 25 or 30 years. And so what that tends to do is it tends to leave the profits and the power with the owners of the intellectual property. And your the nature of how value and profits flow through the supply chain changes. So you can imagine a scenario where these large global companies who own the know-how will simply hire local production to do the most mundane stamping out of a finished manufacture and offer them a 5% profit margin or a 10% profit margin. And I think that could end up being quite problematic for local economies. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, when we go and buy a, in the old days, you might go and buy a Starbucks and you pay £3 for your coffee. A whole bunch of that £3 actually doesn't stay in the local economy. It goes back up to the faceless company that owns Starbucks brand and intellectual property. And that process could get extended across everything that we buy and eat and consume. And so that, I think, forces us to think slightly differently about, you know, about taxation, about global taxation, and about what we ask of companies as they sort of operate in this new kind of meta-global, but also highly regional and localized economy.
We've talked mostly so far about all the negative side of this. Mm-hmm. I wanted us to look at a positive. And obviously, we are still in the midst of a pandemic. One of the positive elements that you talk about is the speed with which we managed to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. And when you compare that, you know, reading the comparison with meningitis, they were shooting 90 years. Mm. There is a really positive element to this advance in technology. How optimistic are you that there are things like that where actually this sort of balances out some of the bad stuff, I suppose?
Yeah, I am optimistic that there's quite a lot of that that out there. I mean, that story is just really remarkable because it touches on a whole number of the foundations that I lay in the book. The genome sequence of this strange virus wasn't called COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 at the time, was made available on the 6th of January 2020. And within a few weeks, the first vaccines had been created on the mRNA platform. And thousands of scientists were looking at that gene sequence. And you know, that used ideas of open source and knowledge commons and, you know, machine learning that Moderna used to accelerate how they found the candidate vaccines. And it was really, really remarkable. The thing to note about all of that, which was, yes, sitting on a bunch of exponential technologies, is that it was scientists and entrepreneurs who did that. And governments were not sort of clunking around, getting in the way in any way, shape or form. So one of the things that we know is that we can respond to these things very, very quickly if we want. And what do we learn from these exponential capabilities that got us these vaccines very quickly? You know, the first was that we had this knowledge commons, these open gene databases for virus sequences. Imagine if the virus sequence had not been treated like that, but had been treated the way that, you know, a company treats a patent or a trademark or a trade secret. I mean, that would have been hoarded and no one would have had access to it. So I think we can learn that there are certain things that we want to put in the commons and that we want to collaborate with, not just between countries, but across stakeholders of many different types. And those might include future pandemics. And when the next pandemic comes, we will get the vaccine even faster. It would also include cyber risks and cyber threats and observing those. And it should also include things to watch climate risks and climate threats. So we can do some sort of observation. But of course, the big challenge of our age is climate change. I mean, that is the sort of most enormous thing that we have to contend with. And I think that, you know, I argue that we need more technology, not less, in order to tackle climate change. And I think we can take some succor from what we saw with the pandemic response, which is that we can look at a wickedly hard problem that had taken 45 years previously, and we can now address it within a matter of weeks, that is to develop a vaccine to a new threat. We do have technologies that are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And so actually it's much cheaper to produce electricity from solar power than from fossil fuels now. So why wouldn't you do that? And so I can be optimistic about us having technologies that, with a great deal of hard work and a great deal of organization, could help us tackle that challenge. But again, as I write, having the technologies is a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient because there are questions about values and governance that will determine whether we do this well or don't do this well. And I think that's also been, you know, the story of the growth of these very large digital technology companies, right? They're very powerful, but we kind of got the values wrong and we got the governance wrong. And that's why we feel a bit icky today.
One of the other things I took from your book, there's a brilliant story about a young woman called Laura O'Sullivan. And your book points out, and I'll let you tell her story, but that a young individual can use this technology in a way that, you know, wouldn't have been possible to do something really remarkable. Anyway, I'll let you tell her story, but I think there's a sort of broader point to take from that.
And it's just, I mean, Laura's story is just brilliant. And it's so, it always brings a smile to my face. You know, I had to go to Dublin in January to go to the young scientist competition that they host in Ireland every year. And it's absolutely the most uplifting afternoon you can spend. And I, you know, happened across one of these booths and I chatted to this young woman called Laura, and she was from a college in Cork. And her project was to devise an AI system that could look at cervical smears and predict whether they were abnormal or not. And it did so more accurately than a trained human doctor. And the thing that's really just sort of baffling and remarkable about that is that this was Laura's first programming project. I mean, she hadn't really programmed before. She said, I think I went to a coding camp when I was 14. And here she is, age 17, writing her first bit of software, and this is what it can do. And it really is a story of one of the drivers of exponentiality in our economy, because many of the techniques that Laura used hadn't existed even 5 years earlier. One of them, critically, was only 3 or 4 years old. It was called GANs, Generative Adversarial Networks. And it was amazing that from a Californian lab and some guy writing a blog post, that a teenager in Ireland who's never coded before can discover that this is the solution to a very, very intricate technical problem she had. She can read about it, find working code, write the code up into her own piece of software, get it to run and have this outcome. And it was really, really remarkable and, you know, tremendous. And there are many other nuances to that story. And her example was not unique amongst this, you know, this young scientist competition over in Dublin. There were other cases of it, but it was the one that really, really spoke to me. And I think when we think about being optimistic, that is something we can be really optimistic about, which is that, you know, knowledge in its power can be more widely available, even in the most unexpected ways.
My final question, rightly you say it's incredibly hard to predict things when the world is changing very quickly, but I would like you to look, say, 10 years into the future. So that'd be 2031. What will the world look like? Just one or two predictions.
Well, I think the first thing is that we will have really started to live with climate change. And that means that the extreme weather will be worse. There will have been many more floods and fires and migrations. But we will have also started to see really, really meaningful steps towards tackling that in terms of electric vehicles and smart virtual power grids and the removal of carbon from the atmosphere and the use of computing to make all of these predictions. So it'll start to feel different against the context of our greatest challenge. Our day-to-day lives, I think, will also have really started to shift, because we will be living much more within our cities and within the 400 or 500 meters of our homes, through delivery services, through remote medical consultations, and through more locally grown produce. A lot of things will still look the same, but many things will be different. And I think it will start to feel distinctly different, because there won't be so many petrol cars on the roads, and there'll be lots of weird looking smart electric buggies that we don't really have words for today. But you know, and I think we will really have started to get there. I mean, the other thing I think that we would see in the UK is we will see ourselves as consumers engaging with many more British companies and European companies than we currently do, because today our technological surface is mostly mediated by American giants. And I think within a decade, that will have changed as well.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Roz. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Azeem for a great discussion and thank you for listening. His book is Exponential: How Accelerating Technology is Leaving Us Behind and What to Do About It. I'm Rosamund Erwin, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.